This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a look at this year's Audubon Christmas bird count and concerns over the possibility of mirror life. We'll talk about what that is. But first, researchers are projecting that by the end of this century, days where deep snow covers the ground will virtually disappear in the U.S., other than high up in the mountains. Joining me now to talk about that and other top science news of the week is Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist based in New York. Sophie, welcome back. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy 2025.
Okay, this first story you brought us is some bad news having to do with snow. Tell me about that.
Right. So there's a lot of parts of the U.S., such as New England and the Midwest, where winter means snow, and they often have a snow cover on the ground of roughly 30 inches or more. That's what the researchers are referring to as deep snow. And that has implications for, you know, how water is stored, the risk of flooding, and a lot of ecosystems that live in the snowpack itself or above it or even below it. And researchers were trying to figure out what was going to happen with all this snow with global warming, because you would think, oh, warming means snow melts. Sometimes climate change actually leads to more precipitation. And so the researchers wanted to get a more detailed model to see what was actually going to happen. And what they found was if we continue to emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases at the levels we are currently, snow is going to really melt away everywhere except really the Rocky Mountains by 2100.
Yeah. I guess the implications for animals, plants, and humans, as you say, are profound.
That's right. There's a lot of small mammals that live in the snow. You know, their fur changes color in the winter to match it, and they are going to either have to adapt or die out. We're not really sure what's going to happen for them. And then there's, of course, you know, the snow during the winter has effects on groundwater for the rest of the year. So it's right. Not just a matter of, you know, missing out on a classic New Hampshire snowy winter. It's also, you know, it's going to affect all the people who live there year round.
Right. Speaking of New Hampshire, that's bad news for the skiers too, right?
That's right. I mean, already ski resorts are, you know, having to make their own snow in some cases. And you know, whenever the Olympics roll around, this topic comes up because having snow is no longer something we can necessarily rely on, even in places that have historically, you know, had beautiful snowy winters.
So New Hampshire will be like New Jersey.
That's what one of the researchers said, and she didn't seem too pleased about it.
All right. Our next story is about ancient fashion. Researchers have uncovered a 2,800-year-old piece of clothing in the Netherlands. What makes this so special?
It's really rare for textiles and fabric to survive such a long time. So this is really exciting because it tells us a little something about the kind of clothing that people were wearing in the Iron Age. And the only reason it got preserved is because the person who was buried in this garment was also buried with jewelry. And underneath the metal jewelry, these scraps of fabric were preserved, even though the body itself had decayed. But there was just enough fabric for researchers to look at it with imaging and molecular analysis and figure out what this cloth looked like.
Huh, and how were they able to do this?
So they used 3D imaging to look at the weave, and that told them what pattern it was. And they think it was a pattern of like plaid called shepherd's check. And then they used molecular analysis to look at what was used to dye the individual threads. And it looks like there was a red dye made from insects, which is sort of what we still use for some red dyes today. And then there was another blue dye that probably came from a plant. And so they think that there was this red and blue checked pattern on this fabric based on the molecular analysis and on the 3D imaging.
Always impressed what they can do with these kinds of things. Our next story focuses on something a bit more recent, an error in a 60-year-old mathematical proof. Tell us what the error was and how did mathematicians discover it?
This is an error that they found by accident. So researchers were trying to translate a famous proof of Fermat's last theorem into computer language so that computers could check the work instead of relying on other mathematicians to do it. And the thing about this proof is it is super complicated and it uses little pieces of multiple fields of mathematics. So when they were looking at one particular field called crystalline cohomology, they found that someone who had written this proof in 1965 had forgotten a symbol between one line and another.
Just one symbol.
Just one symbol. And that made the entire proof invalid. And if this proof is invalid, that makes all the other proofs that rely on it invalid too, because so much else has been built on top of this foundation.
Yeah, that reminds me of my old days in computer programming when I used to do punch cards back in the 60s and you left a period out, the whole thing wouldn't run.
Yeah, it falls apart.
Yeah. Well, were the mathematicians able to fix this error?
Yes. Yes. Luckily, this particular problem was a pretty small one, and there were other separate proofs of the same thing that this researcher had proven with the error proof. So they were able to find another way around it that they were still able to use this. It doesn't invalidate, you know,
right,
decades of mathematical work or anything, but it does show the importance of, you got to check your work. You know, even in elementary school math, you know, it's very easy to
right,
forget one step and then screw up the whole answer. And so it's the same in, you know, professional advanced
yeah,
mathematics as well.
Well, if there was one simple error that really messed it all up, might there be other mistakes?
Yes.
To be uncovered.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and that takes us back to the reason the researchers were translating these proofs into computer-readable language in the first place. They want to make it possible for computers to check the work of mathematicians so that they'll be able to catch mistakes like this when they happen, and to let mathematicians go on and fix it sooner in the process instead of waiting for decades.
Oh, so this happened when they digitized all that math. They were able to find
That's
it.
That's right. It's a process they call formalization,
wow,
which is going to, you know, there's a lot of math. There's a lot of math history.
Yeah.
There's a lot of equations to translate into machine-readable language.
All right. Let's tell our listeners not to blink or you might miss this story. Sorry, one dad joke a show. Scientists have uncovered a new reason for blinking other than clearing your eyes. It might actually give you a bit of a cognitive break. What is that all about, Sophie?
This is an experiment that I love because they basically took some subjects, gave them an Agatha Christie novel, and had them read this novel while having their eyes recorded to track when they blink and what part in the text they're reading when they blink. And what they found is people are much more likely to blink after reading an unfamiliar word or a word just that occurs less frequently in the text. And they're also more likely to blink when they hit a comma or a period. And especially if a sentence ends at the end of the line, they're more likely to blink then.
I wonder if this might be expanded to meeting people and talking with them, and suddenly you start blinking, you know, because...
Maybe. So what they think is this is sort of like your brain's going through a little extra cognitive work to identify that less frequent word, or it sees a natural break caused by punctuation, and you blink to sort of give yourself a break, this like micro rest for your brain to help it, you know, solidify that information.
So blinking is not random. It's sort of suggesting a cognitive process going on here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it makes you wonder, you know, should I be blinking more when I'm studying? Should I be? I think the problem is if you pay too much attention to your blinking, then that probably just increases your cognitive load. But I
right,
mean, it's a thought.
Right. No more excuse. I have something in my eye anymore. Okay. Our final story is about another sense. And I'm talking about hearing and in dolphins. New research suggests that dolphin teeth might be helping them hear? Tell me about that.
This is really cool. Researchers looked at the jaw anatomy of different dolphin species, and then they also compared that to pigs. And what they found was when you're looking at a dolphin jaw, its tooth is sort of set a little bit more loosely in the jaw, and it's also in this spongy socket. So the socket that holds it is a little bit more porous and spongy than you would find in a pig or another land mammal. Plus, there's nerves, these thick, long bundles of nerve fibers attached to the teeth through those structures. So the researchers think what could be happening is sound waves in the water are transmitted to the teeth and from there to the brain where it can be translated into sound.
So the teeth sort of vibrate.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. And you know, something kind of similar happens if you've ever tried out bone conduction headphones, which,
right,
yeah, those are those headphones that sort of, they transmit sound waves through your bone, hence the name, through your skull. And this is a sort of similar idea that this hard tooth or bone is able to pick up these vibrations and send them to the brain.
Any way that we can actually prove this? I mean, this is a theory now, right? Can it be tested?
That's right. I mean, and it's also possible that there's some other sense that the fiber is carrying. It's not necessarily the sound information that's being sent through those fibers, but they would probably have to look at living dolphins and test their hearing and their teeth in that way.
Well, always great stuff you bring us, Sophie.
Thank you.
Sophie Bushwick, senior news editor at New Scientist, based in New York City. And finally, a personal note. One day in the mid-1980s, I was taping a TV show in St. Paul, and the director yelled, "Cut!" And onto the set walked Jimmy Carter, approaching me, exclaiming, "I just couldn't come to town and not say hello." I was flabbergasted. I had no idea he was a fan of my work or knew who I was, but I certainly knew of him, because as a reporter in Washington in the 1970s, I covered Carter's every science policy move, and there were many. He famously installed solar panels on the White House, symbolizing his commitment to renewable energy. He championed energy conservation, asked us all to pitch in by turning down the thermostats and wearing a sweater. He created a standard to make more fuel efficiency cars and set the speed limit at 55. In Colorado, Carter established the first federal facility for solar energy research, and his White House created an act to preserve millions of acres of pristine land in Alaska. Carter was also one of the few presidents schooled in science, math, and engineering, and he put that knowledge toward helping others by establishing a Commission on Excellence in Education to improve science and math in American schools. We will remember Jimmy Carter, of course, as a true humanitarian, but he was also prescient about the importance of science to our well-being. Guided by principles, knowledge, and compassion, Carter had the long, impactful life he deserved, and our country is better for it. After the break, what would happen if scientists created artificial bacteria or other organisms that were a mirror image of normal life?
If you're looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror, and the mirror version of yourself came out of the mirror into the world, you'd still expect it to be you and just be the mirror version of you. So we think that's what it would be like at the bacterial level, too.
And why scientists are concerned. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. You're familiar with the concept of handedness, right? A glove made for your left hand looks basically like the one for your right hand, except it's a mirror image. Well, many of life's important molecules, proteins, DNA, and more, can also exist in either a left-handed or a right-handed form. But it turns out nature only uses one hand or the other in living organisms. Your proteins, for example, are all the left-handed version. But now with advances in biology, it could be possible to build an artificial organism that reverses that order, mirror life, so to speak. Writing in the journal Science, an international group of researchers recently cautioned against anyone trying that experiment, saying that it poses the threat of unprecedented and irreversible harm to human health and global ecosystems. Dr. Drew Endy is one of the authors of that warning. He's also an associate professor of bioengineering at Stanford University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Glad to be here, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. First of all, why might a researcher want to create some kind of mirror bacterium or other kind of life?
It's like research in general. The motivations range from it's cool. Doing something new is unbelievable. There's that element of it. And then it's also practical. Like, what's it good for? There's a lot of things that can be beneficial if you can make mirror molecules. They have different properties that might make a medicine last longer or have different, better impacts, fewer side effects. So it's everything from just pure basic science and the love of science to some fairly, you know, useful possibilities.
Right. Well, you certainly have my interest now. So I want to delve a little bit deeper into this. For example, would a mirror E. coli be just like a regular E. coli, but have right-handed proteins and left-handed DNA, for example?
We think so, is one thing to admit, right? We have every reason to believe it would be a bacteria, but just be the mirror version of the bacteria. So imagine if you're looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror, and the mirror version of yourself came out of the mirror into the world, you'd still expect it to be you and just be the mirror version of you. So we think that's what it would be like at the bacterial level, too. for what that's worth.
Do we have the technology for this today, or are there still hurdles to actually overcome this?
I would say significant hurdles. This is one of those things that is, we believe, possible, but not imminent. One of the reasons why this article came together now is there's been tremendous progress in making MIR enzymes. So the enzymes that make nucleic acids, RNA and DNA, there's been incredible work by colleagues in China, researchers in China, to make MIR RNA polymerase and MIR DNA polymerase. And suddenly you can make MIR nucleic acids, you know, the things that are at the core of life, the so-called central dogma. So you look at that and you go, wow, like this is really significant progress. On the other hand, you know, other things that biology absolutely needs, like the ribosome, the so-called molecular machine that makes proteins, nobody's made a MIR ribosome. And that's going to be a lot harder to pull off. So, you know, there's debate within the research community in terms of how far away are we from somebody being able to do this. And some of my colleagues will say it's 10 years away or 30 years away, or it's never going to happen. I don't look at this so much like a scientific project. I look at this like a construction project. One of the things I've learned is when you're trying to explain how long it might take to do something, if it's a science project, I think it really has a lot of ambiguity. But if it's a construction project, the better way of thinking about how long it's going to take is not how much time it's going to take, but how much money it's going to take. And so I might imagine that it would take somebody, you know, $500 million to make a serious attempt at building, say, a MIR E. coli. Now, $500 million is a lot of money, to say the least. But when you look at the types of projects that get organized in research these days, you think about the artificial intelligence work, you know, there's a lot of people who can organize that amount of money. And so, from my perspective, you know, that really helped me feel that it was important to talk about this now before anybody could get organized enough to make a serious overall attempt at it.
Okay, let's talk about this. You and your colleagues who shared these opinions with you, you're very concerned about this. What are your concerns?
Yeah, it's interesting. For me, before this conversation started within the research community, I wasn't waking up in the morning and going, oh my gosh, MIR life, what are we going to do about it? However, when some very good colleagues approached me to talk about it, my background in engineering is about building cells, building regular cells, not MIR cells. You know, I bring that type of expertise to the puzzle. The initial concerns expressed are that if you made a MIR E. coli, that such a bacteria would be able to get into our bloodstream, get into our bodies, and our immune system would have a very difficult time recognizing it, developing an immune response to it. And so suddenly the type of infection you might be at risk of would be greater than normal. You know, eventually it might figure it out, but at which point your immune system might be on its heels. So that's more than a little bit concerning, and you could start there. Of course, we should be able to develop antibiotics, but they'd have to be new antibiotics. And so if you look at this, why would you ever make a microorganism that's resistant to most of our antibiotics? That's a really bad idea. So a lot of people start with that, and that in and of itself is sufficient. Actually, I should back up and say something pretty carefully. When people hear about the idea of, say, a MIR E. coli, it'd be like, well, it would have to grow on MIR food. You know, the inputs that power this E. coli, where are they going to come from? And because a MIR bacteria would eat MIR food, right? And that'd be a reasonable assumption to make. But not every molecule is a MIR molecule. There are some things that don't have chirality, don't have handedness, things like glycerol. And so E. coli can grow on things that are not chiral. And so within your bloodstream, there's enough food, we believe, for a MIR version of a microorganism to reproduce. The other thing that people often wonder about is where are the amino acids, the building blocks of the proteins, going to come from that have the MIR handedness? And these bacteria that we already have in nature are pretty well equipped. They've got a good biochemical kit, and they actually can make all their amino acids if they need to. And so E. coli can already make all 20 amino acids. And so a MIR E. coli could make all the MIR ingredients it needs to reproduce. But in any case, the thing that really did it for me was when we started talking about nature and ecology. And so imagine if a MIR bacteria was made and it got out into the environment. It would come into competition with all the natural organisms. And, you know, I don't think it would take over in and of itself, but it would probably establish a niche, be hanging out there. And so then the question is, so what? And then the problem becomes, and this might sound a little funny or strange, you know, think about all the other creatures that are now going to encounter this thing. You know, like my favorite example is chipmunks. I love chipmunks. And so if a mere bacterium could infect a person, it could probably infect a chipmunk too. And you know, unlike a person, I'm not going to be able to go to clinic and get antibiotics, you know, the new mere antibiotics. The chipmunk's just going to get be toast. And so having a mere microorganism that was promulgating through the environment and establishing itself as a basically in different new niches in the environment would seem to offer the possibility of a fairly grave hazard to many, if not most, other creatures out there in our various ecologies. And that to me feels closer to existential, something I don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
Right. Do people working in this field see the threat that you do? You said that their existential threat is not quite your existential threat, but is there any form of ethics here about stopping this work, like there was back in the 70s when genetic engineering started, to stop it and say, "Hey, let's think about what we're doing here"?
I think that's exactly what this article is about. You know, you've got a significant coalition of scientists from many countries, some of whom had been doing work towards building mere life, and we're all coming together and we're saying, "Don't do it," and let's talk about it.
How would you get together and talk about it?
There's a couple different things, right? So one thing we've done is created a resource where people can ask for money to get together and have a conversation about it. So there's a you track down a website called Mere Biology Dialogues, and if you want to have a meeting to talk about this, you know, seriously, you can get some support. So there's going to be a whole bunch of conversations throughout this year, including Institut Pasteur to talk about it. Since you mentioned in passing the conversations in the 1970s, it's worth acknowledging that, you know, the big conversation happened in February of 1975 at Asilomar, California. So the 50th anniversary of that event is coming up next month.
That was Paul Berg, I think, if I recall.
Yeah, my late colleague Paul Berg and others, Maxine Singer,
Right.
David Baltimore, they organized that meeting in February 1975. We are having an event at Asilomar at the end of February to talk about things arising in biotechnology today and how to best mind them. One of the five topics we'll discuss is building cells and mere cells, the possibility of mere cells specifically. So that's another example of a conversation coming up soon.
Right. That's interesting to know because I remember that conference. Let me just backtrack a bit and understand exactly what you're saying. Are you saying do not ever do it at all, or can you see a place in which it can be done safely?
Right now we're saying don't do it. And you know, let's stop working towards this goal and not proceed further. You know, if people want to put forward a good case for why we're wrong, we'd love to hear that. But right now, our position is let's not do this. You know, I want to give a lot of credit to the colleagues working together to do this. You know, again, you know, some of the signatories on this and authors of the piece are folks who had, you know, until before we had this conversation, this is what they're doing. And they've decided that, you know, very courageously. It's like, actually, you know, I've thought about this and this is a bad idea and we shouldn't do it. You know, again, somebody's not going to do this tomorrow. It would take at least 1,000 days of 1,000 people working on it. That's as fast as you could do it, I think. Right. And so it's a type of decision-making process. It's more like deciding where you want to sail when you're leaving the harbor, but before you leave the harbor, or as you're leaving the harbor, as opposed to, hey, I better steer the ship when we're about to crash on the reef.
Right.
Now, what was it? It was in 2023 when you had a whole bunch of folks in artificial intelligence, you know, frantically signing letters about the dangers of AI. But like, meanwhile, you've got huge organizations fired up running as fast as they can to make artificial general intelligence. That, you know, that's what it looks like when you're trying to steer the ship and you're very close to crashing on the shores,
Right.
right? Whereas out here, I think we're actually some people would say you're too early. You know, this isn't imminent, but actually, that's when you want to make good decisions, when it is too early.
You know, this all sounds somewhat threatening for just a few days into the new year. But let's talk about some positive things. What are you excited about in your field of synthetic biology? What should we be looking forward to?
Well, I put my engineer hat on. The way I think about it is the physics of flourishing are really terrific. Biology as a domain, living systems, they and we operate at this intersection of energy and materials. You think about photosynthesis, all the plants on Earth, they're harvesting about 100 terawatts of energy. A civilization's running on about 20 terawatts of energy. You know, so 100 is five times more than 20. So when I say the physics of flourishing are outstanding or really good, what that suggests, you know, just the back of the envelope math is if we could partner with biology correctly, we could get to a near future where within a generation, humanity would be able to equip ourselves with the capacities to make the stuff that we need without being in conflict with the rest of life on Earth. Right. So it's fairly easy for me to imagine things working out pretty well on this planet. And for that to be true within our children's generation, if we just went all out and made it real. So then to come back to your question, Ira, you know, like what's going on with synthetic biology? If you've never heard about synthetic biology before, it starts with the word synthesis. And you know, I'm in love with the word synthesis. You go back into the history of that word. It means composition or putting together. Think of a musical synthesizer, you know, composing a piece of music or performing a dance. And so when you put the word synthesis in front of biology, you know, we're learning how to compose biology. This field in its modern form is about 20 years old now. And just looking at the arc of basic progress in the field, we're starting to get better and better and better at composing biology. People are building very complicated pathways inside cells to make medicines in new ways. This last year in 2024, I don't know about you, but I had two bioengineered creatures in my house. One was a bioluminescent petunia that emits light. I gave it to our boys and they were nightlights. And then these so-called blueberry tomatoes with some snapdragon genes in them that make antioxidants like in blueberries. I don't grow a lot of tomatoes, but these are the first tomatoes I grew and they're pretty good. But it's interesting, right? It's like this first time in my life I'm a consumer we have consumer electronics. Now we have consumer biologics. And so that was shocking in a good way to me last year. I've got a colleague, Mike Fishbach at Stanford, who's done incredible work with his team on reprogramming the bacteria that live on our skin. There's a microbe called Staph epidermidis. And they can have that organism present an antigen and tickle your immune system so it develops an immune response. This has been done in mice, not people. One of the early demonstrations was to develop an immune response against melanoma. So imagine having a skin cream that vaccinates you against skin cancer. There are a lot of reasons in my world to be excited about what biology could offer. And when you zoom all the way out to the planetary scale, you know, it feels like we can develop biotechnology in safe and responsible ways and basically give it to folks so that they can solve local problems. If I link it back to, you know, the topic of building cells, the thing that's still true about bioengineering today, it's like before we had the light bulb and you know, Edison and folks were working on how do you get a light bulb to work, and they had how many light bulbs did they have to prototypes did they have to test? And it was like tinker and test. Bioengineering is like that still, because biology is still very mysterious at its core. There's no cell on Earth that we totally understand yet. And so what that means is we take our best and brightest ideas, and once we implement them in a DNA molecule, we have to test that molecule to see if it's actually going to work. We don't know ahead of time. It's not like building a building or even building a bridge or airplane where our models are good enough. We can test it on the computer before we build it. You really have to test biology and reality to show that your designs work. The most exciting thing to me, I think we're on the precipice of understanding how to build cells, natural cells, not mere cells. And that will become a foundational platform, a big breakthrough that makes routine the building of biological systems at the cellular scale. I think of it like there were computers before operating systems and then computers after operating systems. And I see that bioengineering is about to get its first operating system at the cellular scale. So that's what I'm most excited about. If you want me to nerd out, you know, that's where I am.
We'll have you come back and talk about this because this is fascinating. Dr. Endy, happy new year, and thank you for enlightening us about this fascinating world.
Happy 2025, Ira. Looking forward to making the world pretty good.
We too. Dr. Drew Endy, Associate Professor of Bioengineering, Stanford University. We have to take a break, and when we come back, it's been 125 years of Audubon's Christmas bird count. We'll catch up on what's happening this year. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This winter marks the 125th anniversary of Audubon's Christmas bird count, when bird nerds across the Western Hemisphere trek out into the cold to record all the birds they see and hear. Scientists get to use all that data to understand how birds are faring, where they're moving, and what they're up to when it's not breeding season. With 125 years under its belt, the Christmas bird count is the longest-running community science program in the world. So, how do scientists use this data, and what have they learned in those 125 years? That's what we're going to talk about with my guest, Dr. Brooke Bateman, Senior Director of Climate and Community Science at the National Audubon Society in Stony Brook, New York, and Dr. Janet Ng, Wildlife Biologist at Environment and Climate Change Canada in Regina, Canada. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Brooke, let's take a trip in the Wayback Machine. I mean, how did the bird count start over a century ago?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool story. So back in 1900, Frank Chapman decided that the traditional Christmas hunt was not the best idea. And he went and encouraged people in a newsletter called Bird Lore to go out and do a Christmas census or go out and count birds instead, and really was hopeful that folks would take this on board. And a few folks did. So the first year we had 27 individuals from 25 different locations that decided to count birds instead of go hunting around the Christmas time period.
And about how many do you have now?
We have over 80,000 volunteers that participate across the entire Western Hemisphere. So it's grown substantially since 1900.
Okay, Janet, tell me what you did for the bird count this year.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. We've been going out every year to do the Craven Christmas bird count. So that's just a few minutes north of Regina. And we get two territories to go stake out and go drive and walk around. And we took some friends. We packed a lot of snacks and went looking for birds. This group was a few different biologists packed into a truck. And I have to say it was probably pretty intense. It was pretty intense. It was like there are 9 gray partridges, 3 o'clock to the east there, and stop the vehicle, pause, everybody take a look. I was the designated scribe, which I don't want to underestimate how important that task is. I had the little notebook and pencil and I kept track of what everybody saw. It was a pretty serious group, but honestly, it can be anybody who's interested. And that's the beautiful part about Christmas bird counts. It's the opportunity to like see something new, learn something new, and hang out with some probably very nerdy bird people.
Now, I understand that this can get pretty competitive, right?
You know, I'd have to say there's probably a little bit more trash talking by text messaging now than there probably was in 1900. and I'd say that's good motivation for some of us who
right.
work that way. Yeah.
Right. And so tell me what the coolest bird you saw this year.
Ooh, good question. So we started off strong and we were looking at a sharp-tailed grouse sitting in a field. And then we noticed a bald eagle actually come zoom in and check it out. The sharp-tailed grouse wasn't going to have anything to do with it. And the bald eagle thought better in that moment. But it was still really neat to see, like, two beautiful birds and just a wonderful natural interaction out on a really lovely Saturday.
That's cool. And you, Brooke, what was your plan like?
I do the Christmas bird count every year with my daughter. I've been doing it with her since she's 3. She's now 10. So we go out, the two of us, in our local area, our part of the sector, and cover our area. And it's just a fun way to spend the day and get her to recognize and identify the birds. So I always find it as an enjoyable experience. And as Janet said, it's just an opportunity for anybody to join. It doesn't have to be just seasoned birders. It can be children. It can be newbies. Definitely a lot of opportunities there.
Was there any bird that you were really hoping to see going into your bird count?
I think the thing about the Christmas bird count is that you just, it's the opportunity of what you see that particular day. I mean, obviously you want to make sure you're getting the regulars that you see everywhere, because we really want to get a good idea of the birds that are in that particular circle over time. But I mean, if there's a rare bird in the area, it's always exciting to try to find it. I'm always happy to try to get the owls. I think for me, owls and the weird winter ducks are my two favorite hits.
You can see owls during the day.
I mean, you can, but you also, a lot of folks do an owling component of the Christmas bird count where they actually wake up early to hear the birds calling. So obviously seeing a bird is a big part of Christmas bird count, but there's other ways that you can identify birds, including hearing their calls.
Can you give me an owl call?
Oh, yes, I can. I can. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? That's the barred owl.
I thought it was here with us in the room. That was wonderful, Dr. Bateman.
Thank you. I'm not one of those people that can actually sound like an owl, but I can do the mnemonics.
That's good. And Jenna, I know you're a scientist. Why is this data so important to scientists?
Well, we've seen Christmas bird count data used in so many studies now, and the importance of this long-term data set, like literally the longest in the world, starting from 1900, there's nothing else like it that exists. And so having a long data set over a large geographic area, all of Saskatchewan, all of Canada, United States, that gives us so much data to work with so we can look at species trends over continents, but also regional trends too. What's happening more locally? There's just a lot of opportunities and people have really used it to its full extent, I think. Or actually, you know what? I think we're not at the full extent yet. There's more to come.
Is it helpful that this bird count is done in the winter versus another season?
Well, I think it's a good complement to the breeding bird survey, which is a longstanding survey where folks go out and count birds during the breeding summer and spring period. We don't have another count that documents where birds are in the winter. And so I think it's really important for us to understand that the full annual cycle of birds, what's happening in their non-breeding season, as well as their breeding season. So it's really important data set for us to understand and take a pulse of birds in that wintering time period.
Janet, do you have any example that you can share why the Christmas bird data is so important?
Yeah, I think like Brooke just makes these really great points, because up here in Canada, we have a lot of birds that decide that cold winters are not their thing. And so birds migrate. Lots of birds migrate south to places that are warmer, where food is easier and life is easier. So for us, we wave goodbye to a lot of birds in the fall, wish them good luck, and hope to see them in the spring. But we don't often know where they go, how they're doing, or where they end up. There's a really cool study done about 10 years ago by Scott Wilson, who's also with Environment and Climate Change Canada, who used Christmas bird count. And I don't know if he was surprised by the results. I think the rest of us were surprised by it. Him and his other scientist buddies showed that Western grebes had actually changed where they spend their winters by over 900 kilometers. And so we had Christmas bird counts in this around the Salish Sea. So that is off the west coast of Canada, United States, around the Washington area. Christmas bird counts for years. And they noticed that Western grebes just plummeted. They went down by 95% in those recent years. And so then everybody, of course, was very, very concerned and wonder what's going on, what's happening with their population. And then meanwhile, people who were doing Christmas bird counts in Northern California were like, has anybody seen what's happening with the Western grebes? And they saw a 300% increase. And so that paper showed that this species was moving where they were spending their winters by like the stretch of like the span of three states, essentially. And what we hypothesized that these Western grebes are doing, so they're probably moving to where the food was better. And so with climate change, we're seeing fish stocks change, where they spend time and how many there are. And that's essentially the biggest food source for Western grebes. And so Western grebes in the Salish Sea decided that it was not working out for them. There's not enough food. And so they went and scouted out an area, and they all ended up on the northern coast of California. Without a continental long-term data set like that, we would have no idea to be able to join these two apparently separate, but apparently very linked and very connected populations. And we wouldn't know that.
Brooke, you lead Audubon's climate programs. Have you relied on Christmas bird count data before?
Yeah, the Christmas bird count data has been a really important tool for us to understand how birds are already responding to climate change. We actually did a study a couple of years ago led by Sarah Saunders and folks here on our science team, where we showed that winter ducks in the eastern U.S. are actually expanding their range northward because our winters are becoming more mild. And some species are just overwintering and foregoing their traditional migration southward because the conditions are just so much more mild in their breeding grounds. So they're just sticking around. And so we're seeing these shifts. We're seeing these ducks kind of moving northward and leaving their southern part of their range in the winter. We're also seeing that birds are shifting their ranges across the board, across North America in terms of climate change. And we see that we're already seeing the climate change showing up every day in where these birds are occurring.
And does the bird count tell us anything about whether we're losing populations or gaining populations?
Yeah, so it is starting to give us some information. And we also did a study a couple years ago that looked across all bird species that we counted in the Christmas bird count. And we're sort of seeing this change across the board where climate change is really dictating the climate is showing where birds can occur. But within their ranges, changes in habitat have really led to changes in populations for different species, particularly with our wetland species and our grassland species that have seen dramatic habitat loss. So the information from the Christmas bird count is really showing us how global change is impacting these populations. And we know from a study in 2019 that we've lost 3 billion birds. That's nearly 1 in 4 birds that no longer exists today because of changes in habitat and climate. So lots of information there, like the Christmas bird count has showed us that populations are being impacted by the things that are changing in our environment.
As somebody who's been doing the same bird count for the last few years, it is a little wild that you can see some of those changes. If you're one person doing a bird count in one location, it's almost anecdotal. That's your story of what you've seen. And there could be a rainy day, a windy day, a cold day. But everything that you see over the years and then compiled it with everybody else's data, that's what tells the big story. And that allows us to pick apart the patterns and really be able to understand better and forecast what's going to happen with bird populations.
I know you've been participating in the bird count over years. Has it made you feel more connected to your local birds, or do you just get tired of counting them, same birds?
Never, never get tired of counting the same birds. In fact, it's been really neat. You get to know your route. You get to know your territory in your Christmas bird count. And so we had a couple of folks that were new to Christmas bird count with us this year. And we sounded like veterans, like we knew what we were doing out there. Like, oh, we usually stop here and we listen for a blue jay. Of course, none of those birds manifested as we were saying these things. But you do get to know your route and you get to know the habitats and you have an expectation of what you might find there. It's kind of like doing a nice familiar route. I quite like it.
That's great. And Janet, I know, as you've said, your work is focused on shore birds and water birds. Do you have any concerns for them as we kick off 2025?
So going into 2025, we've got a very, very close eye on shorebirds. As Dr. Bateman mentioned earlier, there was a study that had shown that we are several billion birds shorter than we were a few decades ago, and that's really alarming. A recent report by Environment and Climate Change Canada, the State of Birds of Canada report, showed that a couple of groups of birds are in particular decline. So grassland birds have really suffered from loss of habitat, and so their declines have been extremely steep the last couple of decades. And shorebirds, unfortunately, have also seen a massive decline in the last few decades and a very extreme decline in the last 10 years. So a lot of the work that we're doing now is really focused on learning more and getting more detail and really digging into what's happening with shorebirds. So that includes birds that might breed in our local wetlands, but also a really strong emphasis. We're closely looking at birds that breed up in the Arctic, in the tundra.
The bird count is coming to a close for this season. People listening now are going to say, how do I get involved maybe for next year? What advice do you have?
Yeah. So the great thing about the Christmas Bird Count is it's open to anybody and it's free. And the way that you kind of connect to a Christmas Bird Count is to find your local compiler. And so you can go to christmasbirdcount.org and go to that the information there to find the circles near you. So all of our CBCs are 15 mile diameter circles where you can see if it overlaps with where you live and then reach out to that compiler in that area. And I know that Birds Canada that manages the program in Canada also has a website that you can check out your local compiler. So connect with your compiler, and there's tons of way to join. If you're not able to do a traditional count where you're out walking or driving around, you can also do a feeder watching component where you can watch the birds that come to your bird feeder. So lots of ways to participate, and it's just a really fun way for folks to get involved.
And you shouldn't worry that you don't have experience. You'll get training, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about a tradition like this. There's so many people that partake in the Christmas Bird Count that folks that are new to it can be paired with a veteran that's been doing it for a really long time. And it's a great way to learn about the birds. So find your local count, get involved with the folks that they're doing it. And you can really just learn a lot. Just that first time I went out, I learned a ton from folks that had been doing it for many years.
And is that what it takes, just a day?
Just a day. It's one morning for your local circle. Unless you're going to participate in more than one circle, then it might be multiple days.
Oh, do people do that?
Yeah, I know quite a few people that do multiple circles. So if you're ambitious, you can contact circles anywhere that you see. You can even travel for them. There's some people that will travel to Latin America to do one of their CBC circles. So lots of opportunities.
What does the Christmas Bird Count mean to people?
I think the Christmas Bird Count is just a wonderful way for folks to have a really enjoyable day birding, but also connecting to something much larger than themselves. As I said earlier, this is a hemispheric program. We have folks counting from Canada down through Latin America, and that information is just so valuable to scientists. And it's just a great way to be a part of a really fun tradition, but also contributing to science and our understanding of birds and their populations. There's people that have been doing the Christmas Bird Count for over 50 years. I just actually signed a certificate for a compiler that had been doing the compiling role in a count for 50 years. And it becomes a community. It becomes a tradition. People look forward to it every year to doing the count, but also afterwards, there's often a tradition of getting together, having a meal, sharing what birds you saw that day, and finding a way for new folks to get involved and kind of continue that legacy of people that care about birds in one account. So I just think it's become this beautiful tradition that people are just passionate about. They're passionate about the birds in their area, and that they see the value in this program. And so people really care a lot about the Christmas Bird Count.
I was going to say that one of the highlights after doing the Christmas Bird Count is seeing all the data that's been compiled for your area and comparing it between years. It doesn't take a scientist to see differences between years and to wonder why and to ask those kinds of questions. And so, yeah, seeing your hard-earned fruits of your labor, the data is one of the best parts.
Well, good luck with all this data, and thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Dr. Brooke Bateman is the Senior Director of Climate and Community Science at the National Audubon Society based in Stony Brook, New York. Dr. Janet Ng is a wildlife biologist at Environment and Climate Change Canada in Regina, Canada. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And of course, if you missed any part of the show or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. Have a great weekend and a happy new year. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, live with OPB from the World Forestry Center in Portland, Oregon. Thank you. You know, we can decide wherever we want to go to. We take the show on the road. And when we come to a place like Portland, we have to think, what can we find there that is unique, that we can't find anywhere else in the country? And who are the local experts who can help us see the world in a different way? So you look around at the towering trees, and you say to yourself, why don't we go into the woods? And that's what we did. And we went into the woods, and we decided to explore the very often overlooked world of lichens. A lot of people don't know what lichens are. They are a remarkable fusion of fungi, algae, other tiny bacteria, and they thrive in the misty forests of the Pacific Northwest. And from their crucial role in ecosystems as indicators of air quality to their striking colors and forms, we've really taken a liking. I have never heard of this joke before. I apologize. So we're going to be joined by the few people who can tell us all about them, and let me welcome them to the show right now. Right on my left is Hannah Prather, postdoctoral researcher and visiting assistant professor of biology at Reed College, where she teaches about the relationship among lichens, host trees, and the surrounding ecosystem. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Jesse Miller is lead botanist for the Washington Natural Heritage Program, where he provides guidance for rare plant conservation efforts. That sounds cool. And studies effects of altered fire systems on plant and lichen communities. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Sarah.
I'm going to start with you. Hannah, tell us how you got interested in lichens, because I was out there with you today, and you were just in your... You were in your element, as we say.
Yeah, this is true. Oh, such a great question. You know, when I started in graduate school, I started climbing trees. And there's kind of a lot more to that story. But as I was up in these big tree canopies here in the Northwest, some of our towering Douglas fir, I started to notice these little plants, or what we now know as lichens, that were occupying this really incredible three-dimensional space. And I think it was sort of through that connection from the canopy to seeing the things that were thriving and living up there that I really had a lot of curiosity to ask more questions about those organisms.
Yeah, very interesting. And Jesse, as I say, you help guide how rare plant conservation happens in Washington and Oregon. And how do lichens fit into that picture?
Yeah, well, lichens have been overlooked for a long time relative to animals especially, but plants as well. We just haven't given very much attention to the rare lichens, the lichens that are perhaps even on the edge of extinction. And so one of my personal and professional missions in life is to try to bring more attention to our endangered lichens. So that's been a focus of mine, especially for the last couple of years since I've been in Washington.
Okay, so let's begin by helping us to understand lichens' ecological niche. I mean, they have one, right? And of course, we say they, and you were telling me, Jesse, that the plural of lichen is lichens, right? That's
exactly
the correct way to say it. People get it wrong?
Yeah, people say all the lichen out there like it's some amorphous mass, but there are a whole bunch of different lichens out there, and we need people to understand that. It's very important.
And why are they important? What is their niche in nature?
Sure. Well, lichens play a lot of important roles in ecosystems. For one thing, a lot of animals use lichens as a food source or nesting material. There are all kinds of invertebrates that live inside lichens. But lichens also play roles in nutrient cycling. Hmm. They stabilize soil. They play roles in hydrological dynamics. So if we lost some of the lichens in our forests, the casual observer might not notice, but the forest would notice.
And I know that you focus on lichens that are, quote, on the fringe, right? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, well, my background, my PhD research was looking mostly at urban lichens. So how these communities of lichens and these tall tree canopies, how they're being affected by sort of the urban condition of urbanization, the transfer of air pollution, things like this. A second part of my work took place on the Western Antarctic Peninsula, a place of rapid warming on the globe. And so we were looking at lichen and bryophytes, mosses, and those communities and how they're changing really dramatically with warming effects in that area.
Are they significantly different from the kinds we would find around here in Oregon? If you looked at them, you say, oh, yeah, they come from the poles, you know.
Certainly. I mean, Antarctica is a beautiful flora. There are certainly things that are endemic only to Antarctica, but there's also cosmopolitan species that occur everywhere. So it's kind of an interesting blend.
We were out in the forest. You were showing us lichens, and people were asking, could this lichen grow differently if there weren't air pollution? Does air pollution affect
the growth of lichen.
Yes, and many of us might have heard of this sort of lichens can be this canary in the coal mine, right? They're these bioindicators, something that's naturally in an environment, but can also give us a lot of information about the condition of that environment. So we know that lichens respond pretty quickly to things like air quality, pollutants. And one of the main ways that we see this is in their morphology, so the size of the lichen. Lichens don't have protective mechanisms like vascular plants do. They don't have a wax the outer surface or stomata that can regulate sort of gas and surface exchange. And so because of that, they're these little sponges in the environment. So when things land on them, they actually absorb that fairly easily if they're hydrated. So the morphology is kind of one way that they can limit the surface area exposure to pollution. So often in urban areas, we will see lichens that are tolerant of urban conditions. And if they aren't tolerant, they might shrink their size down so that they have less of that surface area touching the pollution.
Jesse, you're nodding in agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you go out to a forest with really high air quality, many miles out of the city, you see a whole suite of lichens that you won't see in the city or in any other more polluted areas. So it's really, and then here in urban areas, we actually see lichen species that are indicators of air pollution, species that actually become more abundant in polluted areas. So there's a whole story to read on the landscape out there.
And I know that you study the effects of wildfires on lichen, right? I mean, does that mean just the heat effects, or is it the smoke and everything that they leave behind?
Yeah, it's a lot of different effects. So there are direct effects. I mean, lichens often burn up in fires. That's one of the most obvious conclusions, but not a huge shocker there. But you know, never be afraid
I hate it
to
when
prove
that
you
happens. You know, it's like,
But there are all kinds of indirect effects as well. Fires change the landscape. They might change a forested landscape to an open grassland, and all those forest lichens are not going to recolonize unless a forest grows back some decades or centuries later. But it's really important to recognize that fire can burn in many different ways. We have what we call low severity fires, fires that don't remove most of the trees and other vegetation, and high severity fires that do remove most of the vegetation. And high severity fires typically have much stronger effects on the lichens.
Hannah, do people walk past lichens and just never know that they're looking at them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Lichens are really good at being very cryptic, right? And so they often are sort of these kind of scummy, scuzzy things that are on your roof or your driveway. You've probably all have tried to scrape them off. I won't judge. So they occupy a pretty unique part of the landscape. They like to grow on other things. So we'll see them on trunks of trees, on rocks, even on buildings, maybe even on your car if it's been parked in the Northwest for a while. So it's very common that people overlook these little organisms.
Well, what makes them different from just moss that we see growing all over the place? What makes it not a lichen?
Yeah, good question. So mosses and lichens actually like to hang out in the same types of habitats. So especially in the Northwest, we have a lot of moisture in our systems. So we see both often really together. So one of the sort of key indicators I always kind of tell my students when we're talking about the difference between lichens and mosses is that mosses are ancient plants. So they always have a stem and leaves. That's one good way to notice them. They also have a little bit greener of a color overall versus lichens are built of fungi. So they often have these really different morphologies that can look a lot of different ways, flat like a leaf or sort of threaded like a little shrub.
Do they share the same space as the moss?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So is this like a symbiotic thing going on there?
No, I wouldn't say there's any sort of symbiotic relationship. I would say it's more of they thrive in the same types of environmental habitats. There is a lot of work in the Northwest looking at stratification of these species across in really tall canopies. For example, we used to have a research canopy crane located here in the Northwest where we did a lot of the preliminary research looking in tall trees to see how these things stratify with gradients of light and moisture. And so what we know is that mosses often like to be in the moisture low layers, low light layers of a canopy or of a forest, and lichens do kind of like to be in the higher bits where there's more high light and a lot of drying as well.
And also, do we find them on rocks? Can you see Yeah, Jesse, you see them on rocks everywhere?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the very best lichens are on rocks.
Is that right?
I mean, lichens will grow on almost anything that holds still. So rocks, trees.
People.
Yeah, you know, probably means you need to live a more active lifestyle if that happens.
Is that right? So because sometimes you'll see... You go through and you see these rocks in a forest, and they have patches on them, different colored patches. Is that what lichens are, also sort of flat, not these big raised leafy things?
Yeah, and those are crustose lichens, those really flattened lichens that are just totally sunken into the substrate. And those are actually some of the most challenging lichens to identify. Those are the lichens that keep us up at night.
Those are the kinds that people are power washing off their... Up their rocks sometimes.
Yeah, you know, some people try to identify the lichens, other people just try to power wash the lichens. That's the world we live in.
Well, they why should we care? And seriously, why should we care about lichens? They're so small, a lot of people don't see them. Why should we care so much? Let me start with you.
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of people don't even think about lichens or notice lichens in their day-to-day life, but lichens play all these roles in ecosystems that we don't see. And ultimately, we're all dependent upon the ecosystems around us. So one of my favorite examples is old-growth forests in the Pacific Northwest are inhabited by flying squirrels that eat lichens as a major part of their diet. And flying squirrels, in turn, are eaten by spotted owls, which are one of our great animals in the conservation history of the Pacific Northwest. So if we lost a lot of our forest lichens somehow, it would affect this whole food chain. And people see the squirrels and they see the owls, but they may not notice the lichens.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're listening to a conversation I had on stage at the World Forestry Center in Portland, Oregon, in collaboration with OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting. We were there to talk about something they have a lot of in the Pacific Northwest, lichens. My guests are Hannah Prather, postdoctoral researcher and visiting assistant professor of biology at Reed College, and Jesse Miller, lead botanist for the Washington Natural Heritage Program. And we had more than 300 curious members of our audience who got to ask their questions about why people are liking their lichens. We've got a question from the audience. Go right ahead.
Are all lichens equally safe to touch and handle? And if not, what are the features you look for that might say stay away?
Are there poisonous lichens?
Boy, okay. I'll do my best. Jesse can jump in. I'm almost like afraid to go on statement here. Like,
no one's listening, so it's okay.
Most lichens are safe to handle, I think would be a safe assumption. There are a few lichens that have sort of toxic qualities to them. One of those is the wolf lichen. It's a chartreuse lichen that's often on the east side forest that we'll see. And it just has known to have some poisonous qualities, so you wouldn't want to ingest it or maybe, you know, touch it a lot and touch your mouth. but for the most part, lichens are really friendly to interact with. Yeah, if you find them on the ground, you can pick them up. There's nothing. Can you think of any other? Not overlooking.
So it's not like possible poisonous mushrooms that you might be
thinking. Oh, no.
No. Okay, I think that's probably what people were thinking of. Yes, thank you for that question. Next.
Actually, on the concept of picking up lichen, I'm a nature and forest therapy guide, and we do a lot of texture stuff, and people like to bring textures back with them, and they often bring back lichen, whether it's still attached to a stick or that they found on the ground. Are those alive?
Yeah, we saw a lot of stuff today in the forest, a lot of lichens on sticks that were falling down. Are they alive?
The answer would be yes. I mean, assuming that lichens can die. They can start to sort of degrade back into the environment. Often those look, like Jesse had mentioned, either bleached, so they've lost the algal component, or they're a little bit necrotic and reddened, meaning that the fungal partner is starting to die. And that can happen fairly quickly if it's in a really wet, if they fall on soil and they can kind of start to decompose back. But typically things that are epiphytic, they like to grow on tree branches or up on other surfaces. If you bring those inside, they probably are still alive if they're hydrated. They can go into that sort of dormancy period if they're dry, and they can do that again for periods of time depending on the species.
I when we were in the forest watching you found a tree branch on the ground, and I have never seen a scientist get so excited about finding a tree branch. What makes that so special about that?
Oh, if you're a lichenologist and you find a branch from the canopy on the ground, it's like total gold. Like, you've hit the jackpot. Because it's really giving us this nice snippet of what we're seeing up overhead that otherwise would be really hard to access. You'd have to use ropes or some other technique to get up there. And so just on that one branch, Ira, we found what? Almost 8 different species just on a very coarse look. So there's probably many more.
And you were happy a dog hadn't come along and just run off with the branch.
Yes.
I get it. Yes. Next question, please.
I'm curious, as we have a room here of people who are interested in lichen, what we can personally do to help encourage lichen growth and conservation. I think about when I am out in nature and I'm trying to not walk off the trail, and thinking about what you said about lichen anchoring on soil to stabilize it. I'm also curious about cryptobiotic soils, but curious about personal responsibility, how we can help lichen and how to encourage its growth and not accidentally kill it, things like that.
Any recommendations? Should you avoid walking on the lichen if you see them in the forest?
As far as those crusts that grow on the soil, we have a saying, don't bust the crust. So don't walk on those crusts. That's one smart move. But I think more broadly, just learning a little bit about lichens and learning to identify some common lichens in your area is one great step forward to being a friend of the lichens and helping them. But one much more specific thing I'd suggest, the U.S. Forest Service is working on revising its umbrella management plan for all the forests in the West, the Northwest Forest Plan. And there are periodic opportunities for the public to comment on this. And one big question, so for many years, the Forest Service has safeguarded or tried to safeguard many of our rare lichens. It's kind of up in the air whether that policy will continue. So I'd encourage everyone to put in a comment and say you want to see our rare lichens continue to be a priority for management.
Yeah, it takes public interest.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Before I ask my question, I have a lichen joke. A fungus and an algae took a lichen to each other, and now their marriage is on the rocks. So when I taught in Alaska, where glaciers had receded, We told our students that you could age how long ago where the ice had moved back, especially places where there wasn't photographic evidence, because certain species of lichen would grow on the rocks at a certain rate. And I didn't know. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
I'm not sure what else to say. It's a really cool thing. I've worked in polar ecosystems, and the lichens there are incredible. I think it's a really... It's been a really neat part of my work to kind of look in areas of recent recession and see what types of species are there, what types of role they're playing, how they transform soils early on in those processes. So it's pretty fascinating.
Is it surprising to see how resilient they are to live in that kind of climate?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think some of the interesting changes on the Antarctic Peninsula are just the change from precip from snow to rain. And so a lot of those species aren't able to kind of handle having more liquid moisture.
Hmm. Interesting. Yes, step up.
Okay, so I saw a video once upon a time of 2 lichen experts that came here to Oregon, and they were at the waterfront here in Portland and also in the gorge, talking about signs of, or like symptoms in lichens of an unhealthy air environment. So if you know anything about that, could you get into some of the basic signs of how to tell your air quality?
Yeah, how do you tell air quality from the lichens?
Well, I'd say one thing to notice is just the size and stature of the lichens. In polluted places, the lichens are going to be a lot smaller. But we also have a lot of lichens that are orange in color that grow in polluted places. And these are nitrophiles or nitrogen-loving lichens, pollution-loving lichens. So when you see just a tree that's covered in orange lichens, for example, that's a sign you may be in a fairly polluted place. And when you see a tree that's covered in big, draping, three-dimensional lichens, that's a sign that you might be in a place with better air quality.
Interesting. It's good, to know that. Yes, please.
So I've noticed at the Home Depot parking lot near my home, where they do a lot of leaf blowing, the trees in the parking lot are just covered in lichen. And I've always wondered if it's because of the leaf blowing. It's blowing the lichen particulates up and sticking them onto the trunk. Do you have any thoughts?
Wow, what an observation.
I think you could set up a really neat experiment to test this.
There's grant money here for that,
I think. I fell in love with them about 12 years ago, and just I'm obsessed with them. So, just
could that be happening? I mean, serious? Could that be an unintended consequence of leaf blowing? And is it a healthy thing to get more of them up into the tree?
I think it's conceivable that that there could be lichen propagules getting into the leaves and then blowing back onto the tree. That would be a great science or nature paper, I think, if we could prove
that. Talk about citizen science.
Yeah,
everybody get it right? You want a citizen science project?
But we actually are still working on developing methods for, I mentioned this idea that we perhaps should be establishing new populations of some of our rare lichens. And figuring out the exact methods we would use to do that remains kind of an open question. So I'll add leaf blowers to the stack of ideas.
Wow. Yes, next question, please.
So when I go to any bookstore and I go to the natural science section, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of books on fungi, but like two or three, if any, on lichen. So I want to know, why does it seem like there is such a deficit of research and cultural like significance placed on lichen as opposed to fungi?
Yeah, it needs better public relations, lichen. I mean, seriously. Right? I mean, people don't talk about it. They talk about the moss. And that brings me to my blank check question I ask a lot of my guests. If you had a blank check and you wanted to spend it on researching or getting public, how is the best way to spend all that money? Is it studying lichens in a certain way or get publicity for it? Or Jesse, let me ask you first. What don't you know that you want to know that you could spend that money on?
Yeah, so we know that there are a lot of lichens that are associated with old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest, but we've, of course, lost most of our old growth forest, which used to cover the landscape. So one question I wonder about is, how suitable are some of our more mature second growth forests, and what can we do to help bring about more old growth character in some of our forests that aren't quite old growth but are nice old stands of second growth, and also doing experiments to try to establish new rare lichen populations in some of those stands? That would be a priority for me.
And how would you spend some money? I'm giving you a blank check. What would you spend it on? Anyway, anything that involves working with lichens.
Yeah, I hate to piggyback on Jesse's, but I think just living in the Northwest and loving our forests and really seeing the beauty of an old growth forest and kind of the loss that we're looking at with increasing wildfire and the loss of Opal Creek. Oh my goodness. I really think that there's some interesting research around these types of questions that Jesse is posing. Can we somehow accelerate those conditions back to old growth? Can we somehow bring in lichens and propagate or attach them into canopies and help like reestablish that biodiversity? I think there's a lot of interest in that.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Next question, please.
I was wondering, since lichens are three or more organisms, how do you begin to like sort them taxonomically and describe that like evolutionary relationship that some of them might have?
Jesse, want to begin?
Yeah, great question. How do we define species for organisms that are inherently composed of multiple species? So the names we actually use for lichens, the scientific names, actually refer to the fungal partners. And part of the reason for that is because pretty much every unique lichen out there is a different fungus, but many of them share the same algae. So that's why we use the names of the fungi rather than the algae. But there are some interesting cases where that system doesn't quite work perfectly. There are cases where the same fungus can partner with two different algae and form two totally different lichens. But because we name them after the fungi, we call those two lichens the same thing. So it remains an imperfect science.
Do we need different names for them?
Perhaps. That's something that's been talked about in the lichenological community. And I think it'll be interesting to see where we are in 20 or 30 years.
Lichenological. I like that. Yes.
The whole idea around symbiosis, I honestly find really romantic. And the way you're even describing those relationships and how they meet each other and how they have babies and all that. So I'm wondering about the... I know this is different than other people's questions, but the sense of is poetry or art or the elements of that relationship inspiring some creative worlds.
Yeah. I will add, just on your romantic notion, that I did have a final project for my lichens course last year. It was a lichen outreach project where they had to spread the word on lichens and what was so great. And I had some students put together a dance about the symbiosis, the coming together of the partners, and it was actually really incredible.
Wow, where can we see that?
It's actually, I think, posted on the Reed Biology webpage.
There you go. Soon to be major motion picture. Okay. Question.
I'm wondering about whether or not we see any lichens in the fossil record and if we have any ideas about their history of evolution, kind of a different turn from the poetry, going a little bit more hard science there. But
good question.
They don't have any hard parts. Do we see them? Like, do we have any ideas about when and how they might have evolved?
Great question. So my understanding is that there are only about 150 individual lichens that have been found as fossils. So they really don't fossilize very well at all compared to a lot of other organisms. So that's one reason why reconstructing their ancient evolutionary history has been really difficult. But we do currently believe that lichens are hundreds of millions of years old. So they do go back a really long ways.
Wow, that's good to know. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm really interested in how cities grow and change, and I'm really wondering whether there's any lessons to be learned by looking at our lichen communities and how they grow and adapt to changing environments that we can apply to the way we design our neighborhoods and our cities.
Well, great question. I think one cool example is after the Clean Air Act was passed, some lichens that were no longer growing in urban areas were actually observed to come back and recolonize urban areas because the air quality had improved so much. So, yeah, I think it's wonderful to use them as an environmental indicator as conditions change over time. Absolutely.
That's great. All right, one last question for the evening for the panel here. What one thing, what one message, what one idea do you want everybody in our audience to take home tonight about lichen? I'll start with you.
Well, one thing that I think that has really been meaningful for me in working with students and lichens is probably that just it's a great connection to nature and they're so ubiquitous. So you can go right outside your door on your city street or in a city park and find many lichens. So I really want to encourage people to just get to know the lichens in your neighborhood, get to be outside and enjoy those. This is the best lichen viewing time because we're having sort of this stormy, wet weather. So it brings down lichens out of the canopy, it brings down branches. And so it's a great way to just connect with nature. Find some in your area and learn about them.
Thank you, Hannah. Jesse, what do you think?
Well, we really are living in challenging times. We are experiencing a biodiversity crisis around us, and we have to make choices collectively about how we want to address this. So my closing message to everyone is please vote.
That's Jesse Miller, lead botanist for the Washington Natural Heritage Program, and Hannah Prather, postdoctoral researcher and visiting assistant professor of biology at Reed College. They spoke with us on stage at the World Forestry Center in Portland, Oregon, in an event we produced with OPB. Special thanks to OPB's Jess Burns and SciFry's Diana Plasker. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at the biggest breakthrough technologies to keep your eyes on this new year. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Each year, the MIT Technology Review people publish a list of 10 breakthrough technologies. These are the things poised to hit a tipping point and potentially change the way the world works. So what do tech journalists want us to keep our eyes on? Joining me to talk through some of this year's entries is my guest, Amy Nordstrom, executive editor of operations at the fabled MIT Technology Review based in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here.
All right. Before we get into the list, can you give us a peek behind the curtain? I mean, how are these breakthrough technologies chosen by your team?
Sure. It's a process that takes us several months every year. Everybody on staff pitches ideas, and we're looking for technologies that are having what we call a breakthrough moment, which can mean a couple different things. It could be for a new medical treatment, for example, that it's passed an important regulatory milestone, or perhaps it's a climate technology that's proven itself in a demonstration plant. So we define it in different ways, and that's part of the fun and the challenge of trying to put this list together. And in the end, we also want a range of technologies from different fields and areas and, you know, some stuff that maybe people have heard of and some other things that are going to be newer to them. And we put all these ideas together and we take a vote amongst our staff just to see what people are most interested in. We have lots of debates and discussions about this list within our team. And eventually we just have to make some tough calls and settle on the final list.
Are you looking mostly for positive impacts specifically?
Not necessarily. I do think this year, I would say, is a more optimistic list overall. But we also look for technologies that are just high impact in general, and that could be positive or negative. A couple of years ago, we had cheap military drones on the list.
Boy, was that right?
Yes, exactly. Those have had a huge impact on shaping wars around the world. And we've, you know, there's other things that could go either way or have both sides. There's biometrics that we had a couple of years ago. Obviously, it could make more life more convenient for us and hopefully more secure, but can also introduce new risks to privacy and personal data as well.
Okay, let's start with a topic that we've talked a lot about last year, and I'm talking about artificial intelligence. There are a few AI-related items on your list. Let's start with one of them, small language models. What the heck is that?
Well, you've probably heard about large language models. Those are AI models that are trained on all of the internet's data, and you can enter prompts or questions, and they'll generate for you a written response or an image or a video of whatever you've described. And those have gotten lots of attention, and many people are using them. But now there is growing interest in these small language models, which don't have as much training data, and they don't have as many parameters, which are the values that get calculated during a model's training that it then uses to produce its results. But these small language models, even though they're smaller, they might be more suited to a specific purpose or task that someone's working on. And some of these smaller models are doing just as well as the bigger ones on benchmark tests that the AI world uses to gauge model performance.
Wow. So what kind of tasks are we talking about here?
Well, for example, if you're a law firm that writes a lot of contracts, you don't necessarily need an AI model that's been trained on every Disney movie that's ever aired. You need one that knows contracts and is really well-versed in that. Or if you're managing a factory, you need a model that can help you keep that operation running, maybe anticipating if there's maintenance that should be done to prevent breakdowns or troubleshoot a problem or keep track of records to show you what's coming in and out. So your model needs like a deep knowledge of your own business and the businesses that you work with, but it probably doesn't matter if it's read the entire Bible and complete works of Shakespeare in order to do that for you.
You know, we've talked about how much juice, how much electricity these AI machines, these giant data centers use. Maybe the smaller language models use less electricity?
Yes, it's not clear how much less really, but because of how they're made, they should be more efficient. So quicker to train, and quicker, more efficient to run, and that should require less energy to do the things they need to do.
Yeah. Moving on, I don't know about you, but I saw dozens of advertisements for something called Google's Gemini over the holidays, and this has made it onto the breakthrough list, your breakthrough list. First of all, explain to me what this product is.
Yes, well, we have generative AI search on the list, and Google's large language model called Gemini is powering this. It's specifically powering what's called AI overviews, which Google rolled out to the US in May. And what that means is you can type in a query, and in Google's case, what's called an AI overview will show up at the top of the search results. I'm sure many of you have already seen this. This is a large language model summary of the topic or answer to your question. And it was generated just for you in the moment that you typed your query. It was not pre-programmed or scripted in advance. So the concept here is that it's more conversational in style, hopefully more useful to you, easier to find the information that you want. You don't have to go looking through a ton of websites and a whole big list of links. The AI will do it for you. But these AI models, including Gemini, don't actually know if the overview that they're giving you is right or wrong. They're just assembling that answer based on their training, which has involved ingesting a lot of material from the internet and regurgitating some of that and predicting the next word in the sentence to kind of fill in the gaps.
Hmm. So it's not just Google that that is exploring this, I would imagine.
Right. Microsoft has infused Bing with generative search results as well, starting in September. That's powered by OpenAI's models. There's also OpenAI now has hooked up ChatGPT into the live web, so it can go there to fetch answers and get updated information to any queries that you might have. And other companies like Perplexity, which has a chatbot interface of its own, are connecting theirs to the web. And in that case, they're relying on large language models by OpenAI and Anthropic as well to generate those results for you.
So now I understand this is quite controversial because it's a major problem for media industries that actually spend a lot of time and money collecting and researching stuff, and then these guys troll it all.
Yes, it is a bit of an existential crisis for the media industry, of which we are both parts. That'll be an interesting challenge for us to try and solve. And there's other problems too. As these AI overviews were rolled out by Google, they started to give some nonsensical results. So there are some kind of funny examples where the AI overview suggested putting glue into pizza sauce to help the cheese stick to the pizza. Mm. And there was also a suggestion to eat rocks for nutrients that came up for one.
I'm writing this down now.
Don't do these things. Don't do these things at home. So, you know, Google has made some tweaks in response to those issues to not pull in as much user-generated data or rely so much on sites that are known for satire and humor, such as The Onion. But sometimes these also still just get things wrong. There was an example where one of the AI overviews said that Andrew Jackson, a former U.S. president, graduated college in 2005, but he died in the mid-1800s. So these new approaches to search will certainly cause challenges and changes in advertising and media. But there's also just some fundamental challenges around how much can we trust these and should, you know, how much can we rely on them as well.
Let's talk about another breakthrough on this list, robo-taxis. I rode in a Waymo in San Francisco, and it's where you can see driverless taxis like Waymo's there all the time. But now they're coming to more cities, right?
Yes, that's right. We've heard about these for years, and companies like Waymo have been testing their services and collecting data and mapping out certain communities. But now they are really starting to expand into new cities and open up these services to the public. There are now autonomous taxis operating publicly in more than a dozen cities worldwide.
And that's what Elon Musk says also. He says his Teslas will be autonomous or a car version of it.
Yes, he just recently announced what he's calling the cyber cab and an autonomous bus as well, and has promised it for California and Texas this year. You know, his company will need to show that that's possible and that they've obtained the necessary regulatory approvals as well. But that was an announcement he made just a couple months ago.
Would you drive in a driverless car now? I mean, a lot of people are hesitant.
I also have taken a Waymo in San Francisco, and I was quite impressed. I thought it was a really interesting experience. And I do think that more people will be trying these out for themselves and, you know, perhaps feeling safer than they do themselves driving or, you know, riding with a driver from another service. So we'll see. I mean, there's definitely going to be more availability of these services around the country and the world.
There are other companies, right?
Yeah, Waymo is definitely the U.S. leader and the biggest in the U.S., but it's expanding to new cities. So far, it's been in L.A., Phoenix, and San Francisco, but now it's going to be in Austin and Atlanta this year. There's also Baidu in China, where they're operating many, many rides in Beijing and Wuhan in particular. And there's also here in the U.S. Amazon's project called Zoox, which is designed more like a bus. It doesn't have a steering wheel, and it's launching to the public in Vegas this year and is also doing tests in San Francisco, Miami, and Austin.
Wow. Wow. All right. Let's move on to some medical breakthroughs that made it on your list. Let's talk about an amazing new HIV medication that has tremendous results in trials. Let's hear more, please.
Yes, this is a drug that could be a much more convenient and accessible way for people to protect themselves against HIV. More than 1 million people are infected around the world with HIV every year still. This new drug is called lenacapavir, and it's administered as an injection once every 6 months. It's made by Gilead. And Gilead announced results in June showing 100% protection for more than 5,000 women and girls in Uganda and South Africa, and then more trial results in October showing 96% effectiveness at preventing HIV in more than 3,200 people of many other genders and sexual orientations. So this is really exciting news and could definitely, you know, help us prevent HIV from spreading further.
Yeah, because the UN has a goal of ending AIDS by 2030. Could this medication make that possible?
It really could help if they are made widely available, although that is not a given. There are a couple other options out there for people already. There's preventative drugs known as PrEP, which can be pills or injections that have been around. You just have to take them every day, though, or ahead of time when you're exposed to a virus, which you might not always know, and people might not remember to take that medicine every day. So having just once every 6 months that you have to, you know, have this injection could make a real difference. But even once these medicines are approved, and this new one isn't yet approved for prevention, it's only approved for HIV treatment, there's still the matter of getting it out into the world, you know, manufacturing it at scale and making it accessible at a price that people can actually afford.
All right, let's talk about another health breakthrough that, to me, following this for I don't know how many years, always seems like it's 5 to 10 years away. And I'm talking about stem cell therapies. Are we closer now? How does stem cell therapies work, and where are we?
We are getting closer, we think. So stem cell research has been ongoing for decades, as you said. And these are very powerful cells because they can be used to make any kind of tissue or cell in our bodies. And scientists have found ways to make these in the lab. You no longer need to use embryos to get them. You can make them from a bit of skin or whatever else. But it's been really hard to translate this research into proven medical treatments. And, you know, it's been a long time coming. But now there are two treatments in particular that we are highlighting on this year's list, one for type 1 diabetes and epilepsy. And they are both showing some real promise.
Wow. And how long until we see this therapy available, do you think? Tell me 5 years.
Yes, it's still a ways off from being widely available. So the trials so far have been very promising results. In some cases, you know, people that underwent the type 1 diabetes trial were able to stop taking insulin. And those that went through the trial for epilepsy had their number of seizures significantly reduced. But these are early trials. They're quite small. The one for epilepsy by Neurona Therapeutics only had 15 patients in it. Overall, there's a couple thousand patients across a few dozen trials. And, you know, the vast majority of those trials are still underway and will need to make their way through proper approvals to actually be available to patients.
Mm-hmm. I know the holiday season is one of the biggest times for air travel. And aviation emissions are a large contributor to global warming, but there are companies working on cleaner jet fuel, right?
Yes, and that's really great because aviation and that whole sector is one area where it's been really tough to reduce emissions. And now, in addition to biofuels, which have been around for a while, there are some new ways of creating alternative jet fuels that are starting to scale up production. Initially, these fuels would be blended with petroleum to reduce emissions in flights, but eventually you could have planes that run on 100% of these fuels. And generally speaking, these fuels can be used in planes as they are. There are no modifications required to the plane.
Okay, let's end with a breakthrough in an industry we don't always think about as having technological advancement. And I'm talking about construction. And in this case, tell me about this steel plant in Sweden that will release almost no carbon emissions. Isn't steel made with carbon?
Yes, it requires a lot currently. This plant is the first of its kind, or will be the first of its kind in the world. And steel is mainly an alloy of iron and carbon, and it's made generally by putting iron ore into a series of furnaces with some coke, which comes from coal, and limestone to remove impurities to create a crude form of iron, which is the key ingredient in steel. But now companies are, green steel companies like Stegra, this one in Sweden, are working on making steel by using hydrogen produced from renewable sources to convert the iron ore into iron, which is the dirtiest step of the steelmaking process. And this company called Stegra is raised almost $7 billion, and they're building the first industrial-sized plant using this method anywhere in the world. And they're hoping to start producing essentially low or zero emission steel there in 2026.
So you're saying they don't have to use carbon anymore to make their steel?
So they're using hydrogen produced through electrolysis. They're using electricity produced from wind and hydropower to split water. And then they're using that hydrogen gas to pull oxygen out of the iron ore to make the metal that we know of as iron. And they're not the only ones doing this. There are some other major steelmakers that are investing into similar technologies. And there's also one that's trying to build another plant in Sweden to do the same thing. So it's exciting to see this progress. They still need to show this all works at scale and obviously get buyers who will pay a little bit more of a premium for this steel. They have locked in a couple of deals in that direction. But hopefully if it works and if it catches on, this could really help us bring down emissions from the steelmaking process.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira. Great to be here.
Amy Nordstrom, Executive Editor of Operations at the MIT Technology Review based in Boston, Massachusetts. And if you want to read the full list of breakthrough technologies, go to technologyreview.com. Lots of folks helped make the show happen this week, including
Sandy Roberts,
Robin Kasmer,
Jordan Smudgick,
Charles Bergquist,
George Harper,
John Dankosky,
Annie Nero,
Jason Rosenberg,
Rasha Aridi,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
Kathleen Davis,
Diana Plasker,
Beth Ramey,
Danielle Johnson,
Santiago Flores,
D. Peter Schmidt,
Felissa Mayers,
Emma Gomez,
Jackie Hirschfeld.
Thank you, everybody. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. And you can reach us all week long on social media, or how about this? Try our newsletters. They're terrific. sciencefriday.com/newsletters. And of course, there is the classic way to get in touch with us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. Happy New Year. I'm Ira Flatow.